Grace and peace from our friends in Cuba. Today we are continuing the conversation and focusing on the changes we observed in Cuba and perhaps what our continued response should be. Or as Jim Wallace may ask in this context, what should the lament of U.S. Americans be alongside the fears, experiences, and oppression of the Cuban people? To be sure, Cubans live in a mixed social environment that is full of economic turmoil. We were told countless times by pastors and others that life in Cuba is complicated. Cubans exist usually at the extremes of their mixed lifestyles and rarely have any middle range or balanced experiences. They are very joyous and describe life as good. They love to dance, they love to have fun, and yet they appear to be looking over their shoulder. As one person told me, it is like Big Brother is watching us. I had many conversations with our translator, Pedro, throughout the week. Pedro is a 26-year-old Cuban trying to make his way. He lives in the moment. He is fun and vibrant and always has some perspective on everything. But he told me that he never thinks about the future because that would be too depressing. The idea of getting married, of having children, is a very expensive prospect, and the opportunities are very limited. Life in Cuba is very complicated. While hope sustains the Cuban people, hope also despairs them. Technologically, the Cuban people are somewhere between the 50s and the current century. Internet continues to be scarce and limited. Jobs do not pay an adequate wage. Most people have to take an underground job just to pay the bills. Pastors make the equivalent of $250 a month. Literacy is very high, in excess of 99%. However, while obtaining an education is a cultural commitment, schools are decaying, and no one wants to take a teaching job because of the stress, the lack of support, and low government pay. The infrastructure of Cuba continues to deteriorate, and yet hope sustains the Cuban people, and hope despairs them. We had many conversations with folk about their view of politics and the renewed relationships with the United States. They, most of them, have a very keen view of Obama, not so much of our Congress. They do appreciate what Obama has been doing on his own to improve conditions. They are somewhat renewed in their hope for the leadership of Raul Castro, but they're not quite sure what that will mean. Hope sustains them, and hope despairs them. Today, there are over 3,000 members of the Presbyterian Church in Cuba. Churches that closed are being reopened, and mission churches are being restarted. In Placidas, where Z. Mara, somebody who has been here at Southminster a few times or once or twice, in her home church, they are constructing a new building which will be one of the biggest church buildings in all of Cuba. But many times they don't have enough resources. They started that project 3 years ago. They may finish it in 7 years. And most churches are going to developing prayer houses, not only for prayer, but deal with the needs, the ever-growing needs of the communities around them. This growth is happening despite the fact that there aren't many pastors. In the Central Presbytery where we are, there are 15 Presbyterian churches, 7 pastors, covering all of them. Hope sustains the Cuban people, and yet hope despairs them. Cuba is a land of many economic, political, and social challenges. And yet, Carlos Ham, a member of the World Council of Churches, has spoken about the strengths of the Cuban Christians. They are academically well-prepared, and in many cases, professionals, unlike other third-world countries. They are sensitive to the depths of their emotions and look for ways to respond and to express them. They are anxious to recover the time they lost before coming to the church and to participate actively in the programs of social renewal and social development. Cuban Christians are eager for change. Hope sustains them with that vision, and yet hope despairs them as well. Our mission with Cuba is about building a bridge of hope, not us to them, but us together with them, one that will repair relationships, one that will aim to rid the despairing conditions of injustice. Martin Luther King reminds us the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. In Cuba, social and economic and political justice is not an easy path. It is complicated. It is very long. It requires perseverance and patience and commitment to each other. So what does this mean for us at Southminster? Can and should we do more than send 25 youth and adults every 4 years? Who is tending to our relationships in Cuba on an ongoing basis? Where do we go from here? Does our hope sustain us? Does our hope despair us? I want to invite Michelle, Janet, Bryn, and Carter forward to discuss some of these topics more in full. So Janet and Michelle are both elders in the church, and they went on the trip, as well as Bryn and Carter have been on many mission trips before. I'll start with Janet. Janet, we know the relationships are very meaningful to the folk in Cuba. Can you talk about their kindness and their system of caring?
One of the things I liked most about Cuba was the warmth of the people. Not only the hospitality that they extended to all of us, which was phenomenal, but the care and concern that they show for one another. I first started thinking about this in the spring when we had 2 Cuban women come and talk to us in one of the orientation sessions we had here at the church. I think one of the women was Carter's Spanish teacher, actually. And these 2 women had come through a program to be able to immigrate to the United States. They shared many things with us about their life there, their life in the United States, and it was all very interesting. But towards the end, someone asked them a question about the change coming to Cuba with potentially lifting the embargo and the increase in trade and opportunity. And I sat there fully thinking they would say, oh, that's great, we can't wait for it to happen. But I was sobered and impressed with their response, which was, we're concerned. We're concerned that when this happens, the change will come only for a few. And we want benefits for everyone, that no one will be left behind in an economy that experiences tremendous inflation and opportunity that doesn't extend to all of us. I don't think there's much to celebrate in a equality of poverty, but I do embrace fully the sense of humility, the lack of pretension, and the standing together in a spirit of solidarity as they face their struggles together. A good example of that for me was in Havana, and they don't have drinking water in their homes. And so in order to alleviate that need, the church in Havana has established a filter drinking station where people can come and fill their water jugs every afternoon to take home and have safe drinking water for their families. One afternoon, and here I accept that I had the huge benefit of being fluent in Spanish, I stood out there at the water station and talked to the people as they came to fill their jugs. In the short time I stood out there and had wonderful conversations, I talked with a graduate student in biochemistry, a cleaning woman that works nights at the hospital, an electrician, a doctor, a man who manages a hotel, and God bless her, a woman like myself who was retired and older, and those jugs were heavy to carry. But as they stood in line together, they communicated with one another, they were supportive of one another, and very appreciative of the service provided by the church. And I thought to myself, this is the proverbial water cooler, where it's center of human discourse. In communities and places where there's little disposable income, social life centers around families and neighborhood. You don't purchase your entertainment. And that results in communities knowing one another, protecting one another, and supporting one another. We, as we walked through the streets, people were outside playing dominoes, kids were playing soccer in the parks, people were dancing in the streets, singing, and having all kinds of community in ways that we often don't see in our own area. This carries over to the churches that have wonderful outreach programs. I found in Cuba that the caring and concern that they have for one another is truly something to respect, admire, and embrace.
And Grant, can you talk more about how you experience community in Kaibabirine, where you were at?
So the youth group in Kaibabirine was really tightly knit. I'm going to quickly reference something that Yin Wai said when she was up here talking. She kind of pointed out the differences between our youth group and theirs. Something that we experience a lot here is, you know, it's easy for us to wake up in the morning as youth and go, ah, you know what, I don't want to get out of bed. You know, I'll go next week. We don't come to church generally because it's something that we need to do. We do come because we have to do something. We make, you know, a promise to dawn, or we have to be here because we're doing something. But if it's up to us, it's easier just to stay in bed. And that's not something that the Cuban youth had. You know, they had a lot of family issues. You know, maybe their parents were divorced. Maybe they weren't living with their family. Maybe they were taking care of their younger siblings. They didn't have the sense of family that we have here. And so their youth group was able to provide that sense of familiarity for them. And it was really beautiful. I mean, it was amazing that the youth group could come together around all of them kind of having a common problem and to be able to provide for each other like that. That's not something that we do a lot, in our youth group at least, and that's something that I'd like to see change. Obviously, our youth group here at Southman wasn't born out of necessity for a family. We come because we enjoy the community. We come because we make obligations to Don or whatever. But that's something that I could foresee changing. You know, even though our youth wasn't born out of the need for family, something that they did that I think we could take a leaf out of their book for was they were simply able to provide joy for each other. And I think that's the obligation of a community to do for each other. And I think that that's something that us as a youth should be able to provide for each other is joy, an And I think that's something that a youth should be able to provide for the entire congregation is joy. I think that's something that we should be able to provide on mission trip to wherever we go, is to bring joy to wherever we go. And so that's something that I want to see us work on.
And Michelle, is life in Cuba really complicated?
Yes, life in Cuba is really complicated. I could not wrap my head around how the economy works, for one thing. And in Havana, you have buildings that are crumbling and the debris is in the streets. But our bus driver had a cell phone, as did the pastor. And their clothes looked great, despite the fact that when we went into a store to look at prices, you know, the price of a pair of jeans was almost a month's wage. So I couldn't figure it out. And if I ask, they say it's complicated. But I think the one thing that really stuck with me is in conversations that I had with three different men on the trip. One was Pedro, who reminds me a lot about this adolescent male in a book I just finished reading, where all he wanted was to get the heck out of town for a change. And that kind of was what Pedro was like. He was kind of a mix of he's ready for a revolution to start it, you know, start something new, or just be transported to like the United States where he can just work and have better things than what he has currently. And yet, you know, Pedro has seen every episode of The Big Bang Theory, and I'm like, so how does that work too? And then you compare him with Michael, who was my translator in Camawani. And Michael actually worked a few miles down the road at a tourist town, which we got to visit, and had four beautiful hotels that catered to a lot of Europeans, and he had a good job, and he was approaching 40, and his take on life was, you know, I have it pretty good here. I'm not willing to risk my life to try to get to the United States. He had several friends who had tried and had died trying to make the journey. So he was kind of a mix of, I have it pretty good. I know I'll never be able to afford a car in my lifetime. But, you know, I'm hoping someday that I will be allowed to get on a plane and go visit places. But, you know, right now he's kind of a mix of hope and despair. And then the pastor who was there when we returned to Havana, who's later on in his years, he just looked worn down by life. That he said the embargo, it'll improve things maybe 10%. It'll take care of 10% of our problems, and we still have all these issues that we're trying to deal with. So he was at the other end. There was no hope, and he didn't want a revolution. He was tired. You could tell he was tired. But that's not to say that is that different from, you know, you pick three people here in the United States to talk to. They would all have different versions and visions of what life has for them.
Very good. And Carter, can you talk a little about change and what the pastors say in terms of how we can change and move forward?
My stay in Cuba was, throughout the entire trip, I stayed with Jesus and Pedro when I was in Placidas, so I didn't get as wide of a census with speaking with different people, different pastors. But in being with Jesus and Pedro my entire trip, I was able to really get a more full picture of their opinions on the matters. And most of the time, what came out is they view themselves not as a third world country that is just wanting to receive money from wealthier European countries, Canada, the US. They want to be treated more as a first world country, a country, their own country that can operate by themselves. They don't want to be looked down upon, oh, they're a poor country that needs our help. They are a country that wants to be an ally of us They want to work together. They don't want to be helped. They are very autonomous people. They know how to do things, and it's they feel almost belittled when these mainly European countries come in and just hand the money and run. And they were really surprised when we came there, because they really did feel that we weren't just offering them money and just running and patting ourselves on the back. They really did see that we were different people and that we really wanted to help build connections with them. So it wasn't necessarily aimed at us. We can be assured for that. But they really wanted to enforce that change is not brought through the government, especially talking with Congress and stuff and how that's not going to help us. What we want, what they want, are grassroots movements, is having the conversations with, first between us and Pedro, say, but then also me coming back and talking with people. Obviously, I'm not too good in front of the crowd, but it's sharing the experiences and taking down the stereotypes of Cuba that's going to bring the real change, and not just pouring money and helping in that way, but to really tell people what Cuba is really about and what they really need and how great of people they really are and what they really stand for, and not just that they're communists and terrible people, but they really are great people.
Okay, very, very good. Thank you, Kurt. And then one final question for all of us to reflect on. So what does this mean for us at Southminster? Where do we go from here with the macro needs that are in Cuba, but also the realities of us being, 4,000 miles away or however? What does it mean for us, Janet?
In our conversations in Cuba, many of them reflected on the changes that have happened since Raul Castro took over for Fidel in 2006. Initially, when Raul Castro took over, there was great skepticism about any change, that this was just something that would be a temporary placement while Fidel's health improved. When that proved not to be the case and Raul was ratified in his position, by 2008, it became very clear that he had different ideas about how to manage the country and to pull it out of a very, very difficult period of economic decline. After the fall of the Soviet Union, they really struggled, and they call it the very special years when there was starvation, etc. Anyway, he's made a number of reforms that have made a lot of difference in Cuba. Among them, and probably the most important, is that he has introduced a mixed market type of economy where private business is not only allowed but encouraged. They are trying very hard to reduce the size of the public payroll because without a vibrant economy, that just couldn't be sustained, the low salaries, the lack of purchasing ability, et cetera. Primarily, you see this in terms of small diners and restaurants that are in people's homes. There are little fruit stands. People have opened their homes, if they're able, to be kind of a bed and breakfast. We saw in Santa Clara some little stores where they would be selling party things, all Disney. It comes in those big packages we saw at the airport, and it's really quite a phenomenon to watch the luggage come off the carousel, all the stuff coming in. People are happy about this, but of course it's not open to everyone. You need some income in order to start a business. So primarily it's families who have relatives in the United States that can partner with them. But the mere fact that it is now permitted and encouraged is making a huge change in the country. It also has meant that there's income tax, which is something kind of new and probably not so welcome. People are very reluctant to give up the security of their government jobs, pensions, etc. So mixed economy is the best way to look at it. Another major change that he has instituted is the ability to sell property. After the revolution, many people, as we well know, left Cuba to live elsewhere. If you left Cuba and were gone for 11 months, that property became the property of the state. and then was, in many cases, the large homes divided up and given as small apartments, or whatever you want to call them, to families. Families were given title to that, but they were not able to sell it. It was theirs as long as they or one of their children lived in it. That has changed. Now, the property that where you are living, you can sell to someone else. That's really a major change. We went during our walking tour of downtown Havana to a park. It was really the most phenomenal thing. It was like a Saturday market. They were selling houses, and they would stand up with a sign for sale, and whatever it was they were selling, an apartment, a house, how many bedrooms, and people went there and exchanged, went to visit the house and sold their properties. A woman we got to know in Santa Clara told us that she showed us the house where she and her family were living at the time of the revolution, a huge old house, but hard for her to maintain by herself, needed a lot of repair that was way beyond her ability to pay. So she went to the government and said, I want to give you my house in exchange for something smaller, which is how it would have worked before the reform. The government told her, we have nothing to give you, you can sell it and buy something else. So it's what she did, and she now lives in a small, much smaller home on the outskirts of Santa Clara and is very happy about that. There's also a new immigration law, which is important. No longer is you have to have a white card to leave the country. This was an expensive exit permit. It's no longer required. The Cubans, if they're able to get visas, which is now the big obstacle, are able to travel pretty freely if they're able to afford it. They also have lifted the restriction on people returning to Cuba. If you left Cuba illegally before you were unable to go back, now you can, not only to visit, but in many cases to repatriate. They're encouraging people to come back because they come back with money. And when they come back to retire, they come back with pensions. So it's in their best interest to have people allowed to come back. You're also able to leave the country for 2 years rather than 11 years without losing your property. There's also more openness in the media, and although access to internet is sketchy, it's available. And one of the first nights we were there, we saw a video of a TV program, kind of a combination Jon Stewart, Saturday Night Live, where they were making fun of the Cuban government. And on one of the episodes, Obama actually appeared. It was hilarious. And this is very, very popular and something that never would have taken place even just a few years ago, where you're allowed to have that kind of criticism of the Cuban government. There are many obstacles to change. Maybe not number one, but the one they talk about the most is the embargo. Until that is lifted, foreign trade is very difficult to foresee. There's a crumbling infrastructure, as Michelle mentioned. Things are literally falling apart, and it takes a lot of money to restore it. There's little productivity. The sugar and nickel industries that sustained the economy for years are in disrepair. And there's very little foreign investment at all. As I mentioned, Soviet Union and Venezuela really aren't able to provide much anymore. But there are great positives. The reforms that have been instituted are really important reforms. And no longer do the people fear that they're temporary. Raul has said that he will step down in 2018 at the end of his current term. And the person named to take over is a 53-year-old man who fully embraces Raul's reforms. So I think there's a feeling that hope is always a possibility, and there's also concern, there's confidence that they will move forward. Brazil has invested deeply, or a great amount of money, in developing the Muriel Harbor, which will be a deep water port. When the embargo is lifted, that should provide increased income for the country. There's a very well-educated workforce, which will make it easy for any industry that wants to come into Cuba to find people able to work. And it's an absolutely beautiful country with tourism, I think Mexico needs to worry about the competition with their beaches because the Cuban beaches are wonderful. However, I had to laugh when I heard one person refer to the image of boatloads of cruise ships disloading being like the Spanish conquistadors returning. Obama was received with great affection and optimism when he visited. He was only surpassed by the Rolling Stones that also were there last spring. And they said something like 1.5 million people were standing in, I can't even imagine that, but evidently that's what happened. So there's great, from my perspective, there was great optimism and great hope that future, Cuba's future is going to be much brighter. And I personally hope we can be a part of that.
Thank you. And I'll have, how about Michelle, if you can wrap it up and talk about some of our current thoughts among us on what we might do in the committee that we're going to propose and so forth.
Okay. Well, one of the things Pastor Eldeberto talked about was the importance of taking care of the mission needs in your backyard before being concerned with the mission in Cuba, which was interesting just before he sent us out to our mission in Cuba. So, but, you know, I think about that, and you know, I kind of go back and forth as to what makes sense, and this is something that we'll be talking about, was, you know, that's a lot of money that we spend to go to Cuba. Would that be better money better spent in our own backyard? So, you know, should we travel so far as part of our mission? But then the other side of my brain looks at some of the things we gain from international travel. You know, the American way isn't the only way of doing things. You know, our perspectives are altered. You know, I've never been in a communist country before, so it was interesting to see that the people want the same things as we do. It's just sometimes our governments get in the way. International travel, how does it affect the youth from the way they think about things now and the long term? And, you know, and I was thinking about this when we were watching the opening ceremonies in the Olympics, and Cuba comes out and we're all rooting for them, you know, isn't that ultimately what we want to do, is root for each other? And one of the ways that we start doing that is by traveling and meeting each other. So, yeah, so my rational and sides fight in my brain. But what we're looking at is starting task force, is that what we decided to call it? A task force to look into what the future holds for Cuba and mission trips, and you know, if nothing else, we would like if we're going to continue with Cuba, it'd be better if it wasn't just once every 4 years we call up and say, hey, we're coming. How can we continue that conversation with them? So that's what we're looking at. And am I missing anything? Yeah. If you're interested in being part of this task force, let us know. And that's it.
So, and we're going to propose that session develops that task force to really explore these questions. Currently, you know, going every 4 years and taking 2,000 people, it's a wonderful experience for us, but 24. But is it really making an impact for them? And could we do something in the in-between years? And all of those questions are really came to the surface a few times during our trip this time. So if you've gone to Cuba with one of the trips in the past, we'd love for you to be on the task force, but we'll let you know more about that. Whatever we do, as Pope Francis reminds us, we must move forward together as one in renewed spirit of fraternity and solidarity, cooperating generously for the common good. Amen.